Welcome to Big Nerdy Questions, BNQ. Welcome back to the podcast that just brought you a few episodes ago, the producers of the X-Men animated series, Eric and Julia Leewald, as well as the proprietor of Dragonfruit, Ori. Now tonight you don't have any special guests, but you do have a very special panel. Welcome back to the show, Ed.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back, you know him, you love him, it's Matt.
What kind of special are we talking about?
Well, considering tonight's topic is one of our favorites, it's very special indeed because, of course, it's Star Wars night once again. Yay! And tonight's
now, Josh,
topic... Yes?
I heard a rumor that tonight's topic is a pretty popular one among Star Wars fans. Is that right?
It is a fairly popular one. And you might say that even Britney Spears is a fan because she's a slave one for this one. Tonight's topic is, what is the best ship in Star Wars? We'll be talking about all the various ships that we love and some that we loathe. But before we do that, we have some business to attend to. Well, first of all, I want to thank Eric and Julia again and Ori for coming on the show. Big ups. Thank you so much for that show. Our X-Men show had one of the highest response rates of any show we've ever done, so thank you so much, as well as our Dragonfruit episode. So we appreciate you guys coming on, and we hope you can come on again in the near future. And any other guests who would like to come on BNQ, let us know. We would love to have you in this open environment, because all nerds are welcome in Big Nerdy Headquarters.
Unless you like Jar Jar.
Yeah, it's a bit of a deal-breaker. Just a bit. Let's just say, if you like Jar Jar, we would not match up on Ori's compatibility levels on Dragonfruit. It just wouldn't happen.
That needs to be a question on the compatibility thing. Do you like Jar Jar?
If so, please redirect your attentions to another website like Farmers Only.
Oh. Don't do that to Farmers Only.
GunGunsOnly.com.
Oh, that's just wrong.
Anyway, before we get any further, Matt, who's our sponsor tonight?
Well, Josh, tonight's sponsor is Corellian Engineering Corporation, producers of the YT-1300 Light Frigate, the ship that stopped the Empire. Modifications may apply.
Right.
So you're saying you can buy it as is?
Well, it'll look like the Falcon.
Any modifications void the warranty.
And all the training manuals are in Wookiee. Does Wookiee have a written surrogate that we know of?
I don't know.
I think it may be an entirely oral language.
Because I'm picturing like a Wookiee scribe, which was kind of hilarious. Basically, I'm picturing a Wookiee dressed as a medieval Dominican monk, where he's cut a bald spot on his head and he's wearing a robe and he's transcribing the great sagas of the Wookiee's past. And it's just fantastically funny.
And thus ends the epic of Chewbacca, Crusher of Empires.
They thought about a written language until they had the Christmas special, and then they decided there's just some things they don't want recorded for posterity.
That is probably the truth. Ed, I believe you've come to us tonight with a big nerdy recommendation. What would that be?
Yes, I have. I thought it kind of appropriate, since just a few days ago I watched the movie Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, that I recommend something of J.K. Rowling's, and... this might be a little more obscure. It's actually a detective series that she wrote under a pen name called Robert Galbraith. It's the Cormoran Strike detective series. The first in the series is called The Cuckoo's Calling. The second one is The Silkworm, and the third one is Career of Evil. And I'm not going to get into any of the plot points because, you know, the best mysteries are discovered for yourself. But they're all fantastically written books, as you would expect from J.K. Rowling.
Thank you for the recommendation. I honestly didn't know of anything she had written besides Harry Potter universe books and The Casual Vacancy.
Let me go ahead and inject here. This is a more mature subject matter. Like, if you've seen or read The Casual Vacancy, this is more for adults.
Okay. So thanks for putting that out. And I think it's an interesting recommendation. We'll have to check that out with more J.K. Rowling. And I think what J.K. Rowling and Star Wars have in common, or Harry Potter and Star Wars, is an incredibly dense and enthralling world building. When you're watching a Harry Potter or a Star Wars film or reading a novel, you feel like you are a part of a fully fleshed out universe. So that's a very good segue from one beloved universe in Harry Potter to another with the Star Wars, and specifically the ships. And I mentioned the world building because, in my opinion, the ships are a part of that. When you think of an Old West movie, you have to think of the horses. When you think of a movie set in the 1950s, you think of the cars. And some people actually name their cars. When you think of a pirate-related thing, you think of the ship, like the Black Pearl and Pirates of the Caribbean. And it's no different from science fiction. Those of us who love science fiction love our ships. And I actually have a model of the Enterprise E here in Big Nerdy Headquarters, as well as a model of the Enterprise D that was released for the finale in 1994. So, and I used to have a model of the Millennium Falcon. I think I still have it somewhere, as well as a Romulan Warbird. So ships are obviously important to us. But I want to get briefly into why that is before we talk about specific ships. Matt, a few weeks ago on this very podcast, you recommended to us to play Space Engineers, and it's a great game on Steam. So as someone who dabbles in designing spaceships for fun, why do you think ships are important, and what do you think makes a good ship?
Well, as someone who is a lifelong fan of science fiction, I think that spaceships are iconic for the intellectual properties that they're in. Because if you can name a science fiction IP that involves space travel, you can bet there's at least one iconic ship. Sometimes numerous ones like Star Wars. Star Wars has tons of iconic ships. Star Trek, you know, it's got Romulan Warbirds, the Enterprise, the Borg Cube, all these things. And it's something that sticks in your memory. Mm-hmm. Because there's these wild, out-there designs with these fantastic capabilities that, of course, we can't imagine being in the real world. And it kind of gives us that separation from reality, that escapism. And I think that's an integral part of the escapism of sci-fi, until someone goes and tries to build a working one.
You know, I think you're right that every IP, I mean, Battlestar Galactica, if you don't know, that is the name of the ship. That is the main ship right. in the franchise. Star Trek also has the Voyager. Deep Space Nine has the Defiant. Babylon 5, the space station, kind of takes the place of the ship, but it's still a similar idea. Even when you read books, I just finished a really interesting book called Marrow by Robert Reed, and the main character, if you will, is the ship. The ship is the size of a galaxy. It's hard to describe. It's very hard science fiction, but it's really well written. And the ship is center stage, as is the case in almost every spacefaring IP. You know, look at Firefly, another example. The ship always can take center stage. And Ed, I want you to chime in on this. Someone actually told me that the reason ships are so iconic is because it's just like when someone really loves a classic car. It's more than just a form of conveyance. It's an extension of someone's own personality and characteristics.
Oh, I could easily see that. I mean, just within the realm of Star Wars, the ship kind of matches the persona.
Vader's, oh, yes, it does.
Vader's advanced TIE fighter matches him perfectly. As a matter of fact, it was designed for him specifically. The X-Wing is Luke, because he's, you know, he's come from a rough, coarse world, and that the X-Wing, to me, personifies the entire rebellion, just because they're so scrapped together, as it were. And then, you know, Slave One to Boba Fett, and, you know, so on and so on, Han into the Falcon. They represent the characters themselves, and just like, you know, the great duos in any kind of, you know, science fiction or fantasy or whatever, the ship's almost as integral as, you know, the other cast members.
Yeah, it really is.
That's why when you watched Episode 7, when they first pan up and you finally see the Falcon again after all these years, it's like coming home again, just like Han said.
It is one of the most emotional moments of the whole movie. And I might be wrong in this, but I think one of the reasons that Han's death was survivable as a fan and not just, okay, I'm done, was because the Falcon remains, and it's clearly going to be a central part of the rest of the trilogy in the hands of Rey and Chewie. And in some small way, maybe even large way, that means that Han is still there in some way, shape, or form, too. Han can't be a Force ghost. but the Falcon is in some ways his ghost.
But I can see that.
It's still going to be a part of the movies, and it made his death a little bit easier to cope with. Not easy, but easier.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for episode 7, of course, but you know by now that we do not avoid spoilers on B&Q. Or at least we do
now.
Don't
even try.
So, Matt, I do want to ask you, as when you're playing Space Engineers, when you're designing a ship, how do you balance the age-old debate between form and function? Is it more important for you for a ship to look good or to be able to do what you want it to do?
I personally believe, and this is definitely true in the realm of Space Engineers, is function before form. There's something actually Steve Jobs used to say back when Apple was still, actually doing things. Yeah, looking at you, Cook. he used to say, make it beautiful and then make it work. You have to do it the other way around with the ships. Because if you make it beautiful in Space Engineers, it's probably not going to work. Especially if you do things like I do and try to build full-size Star Destroyers, and it turns out that the base framework to determine the location of gravity generators got so big that my computer could handle it, but the game itself could not.
Oops.
Do not try to build a 1-1 scale Victory class Star Destroyer in that game. I have learned the hard way. It stops working.
Yeah, I actually will point out here, I know this is a Star Wars ships episode, but an interesting anecdote on the Enterprise original design from the 1967 series, or 66. The iconic design of the Enterprise with the saucer and the nacelles is actually Roddenberry's vision was to create a ship that was a combination of the Saturn V rocket and flying saucers. And he said, in the design phase, combine what we know we already have with the Saturn V, which clearly works. And he just expected that space travel would just refine the Saturn V design and not scrap it for the shuttle. And he said, take that and combine it with flying saucers, even if they're not what's really out there. It's a sleek design and I like it. So they combine the two, and that still, if you look at the original Enterprise, it's clear as day that's what they're going for once you realize that's what they're for. And but he also said it has to make sense. We can't build a ship that doesn't make sense for a viewer that it would actually work, which is why they have the warp nacelles off to the side. It's kind of structured like exhaust on a hot rod, where they have it positioned. So it makes sense from a structural standpoint as well. And someone actually once criticized Roddenberry's ship or design, the Enterprise, because it wasn't aerodynamic enough because of the different parts everywhere, to which he responded, it's space. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting, you have to have both.
Yeah, from a strictly functional point of view, the most efficient shape to have for a ship that goes planet side, that actually lands and takes off and travels through atmosphere, is going to need to focus on aerodynamics. But the most efficient design for a ship that never leaves space is actually the sphere.
Yeah.
There's no friction. There's no resistance. So by making a sphere, you have the most usable interior space.
Which is why the Borg used a sphere in later incarnations, because they're all about efficiency.
I thought they were all about that base.
Well, that too.
No trouble.
Ha, no tribble in this sense. Although I would love to see an episode where the Borg assimilate tribbles, but that's another show. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go into the actual ships. And I've talked to some people on the street, as they say, and I've gotten some candidates. And I'm going to introduce some candidates to you guys and get your opinions first. And then both of you are Star Wars experts, and I'd like you to introduce your candidates that don't come up in this beginning, all right? So I'm going to start with you, Ed. And the first one that I had told someone told me I actually spoke with a Star Wars fan last night named Steven. And Steven's favorite ship, he said, it's a combination of scrappiness and its ability to get the job done, even though it's really small. He likes the X-Wing. So what are your thoughts, Ed, on the X-Wing?
To me, it's my personal favorite ship of the franchise. I'm actually wearing a Star Wars shirt right now with an X-Wing on it. Scrappy is the definition of this ship. That's why the Rebels used it, because it was a reliant, rugged ship. Aesthetically, I love the look. It's just iconic. I mean, the Battle of Yavin and the battle with the second Death Star, and even in the Force Awakens, the primary fleet for the Rebellion and the Resistance is comprised of X-Wings. So I think it's just an iconic ship. You know, unlike things like the TIE Fighter and whatnot, it's, you know, it does have deflector shields, and it runs with navigation off of an astromech droid, and that's why you always see Luke with R2 in the back of it and all that stuff. But it's just to me, it's classic. That's my favorite ship of the franchise.
But we'll see at the end if it is the best ship, because there's a distinction between favorite and best. But we'll see at the end.
It's the ship that killed the Death Star.
Yeah, that's true. Matt, what are your thoughts on the X-Wing?
Well, first of all, the X-Wing is very possibly one of the most iconic spaceships in all of science fiction, not just Star Wars. It may or may not be number one, but I'll tell you right now, it's in the top five in all of sci-fi. For just when most people think Star Wars, they think of the Death Star trench run with Luke's X-Wing hauling down to fire those proton torpedoes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the prettiest ship, but it's, and you know, a lot of my knowledge, I believe a lot of Ed's knowledge as well, comes from the novelizations that are formerly canon. And in those, they mention that it's specifically designed to be easy to fly. And that's part of why Luke's able to pick up flying it so quickly, is because it's similar to the T-16 that he flew on Tatooine, which was just this little, you know, comparative puddle jumper. So it's easy to operate, so it's user-friendly. You can plug in the astromech of your choice. And really, the only major design issue that I see is that the astromech is exterior exposed, which does become a problem in the films when R2 gets a pot shot across his dome. And I personally think that's a major design flaw.
Well, I think one of the things that to me stands out about the ship, as opposed to, say, the TIE Fighter, and, you know, within the franchise, it's always X-Wings versus TIE Fighters.
Yes.
TIE Fighters are built for speed with absolutely no shielding whatsoever. And you want to talk about a ballsy pilot to get in one of those things. But the X-Wing has four laser cannons, one at each tip of the wing, and then two photon torpedo tubes, proton torpedo. But it can deal a lot of damage, and I won't say a bunch of hits, but it can take substantially more hits than a TIE fighter could without destroying. And I think that breaks down partially reflective of the mentality of the Rebellion and the Empire. The Empire was built for speed and, you know, just quick strafing runs without regard for their pilots. The Rebellion has a finite number of resources, so they have to take care of their equipment and their pilots.
I see the X-Wing as similar to the multi-role fighters that the Air Force uses. You know, it can be used for bombing. It can be used for limited ship-to-ship combat, but it really doesn't specialize in any one area. It's kind of a well-rounded fighter. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the TIE fighter, which I'm sure we'll get into later, it's built specifically for dogfighting to protect Star Destroyers and the Death Star and large installations that can't really engage in ship-to-ship combat.
We might as well go ahead and get into the TIE Fighter now, because, as Ed said, they're kind of synonymous with each other in the franchise. If you see X-Wings, you see TIE Fighters. So before we get into the specific kind of TIE Fighter, if you know where I'm going with it, let's talk about the general TIE Fighter. And Matt, you already kind of started us on that path. But what are the pros and cons you see of the TIE fighter design?
So, I'm going to start with the pros. I like to start with the pros and then go to the cons. So, it is probably just about unparalleled as a dogfighting craft. It's very much a hit-and-run type vehicle because they're built entirely around being completely short-range defensive. You know, they're not major offensive. They're meant to kind of keep the enemy back from the Star Destroyer or, you know, the space station or the thing that's no space station. That's no moon. Or is it?
If it's Starkiller Base, it kind of sort of is. No, but...
Details.
Yeah.
But, you know, the TIE Fighter is a short-range, extremely high-agility craft. And it's meant to get in, knock down enemy fighters, and go back. So it's really highly specific purpose, and I think it absolutely excels in that area, because look at how decimated the Rebel fleet was by that run on the Death Star. It, just about the whole Rebel fleet went up with the X-Wings and Y-Wings, and what was it, three ships came out of it? Out of that whole fleet?
It wasn't many. And then the Falcon wasn't even part of that fleet to begin with.
Yeah, I think the only ships that came out were Luke's X-Wing, the Millennium Falcon, and then there's a Y-Wing in the background that escapes. And that's the only ones that really came out without completely crippling damage. There were a few people who had to pull out and go back, but their ships were done.
Yeah, in my view, I've always kind of thought of the TIE fighters as the drones of a honeycomb. You know, they're not going to bother you unless you're attacking the honeycomb, in which case you are going to get stung repeatedly.
Yes.
And I don't think it's an accident that the sides of the TIE fighter have a honeycomb pattern on them. I don't think that's an accident. Or at least the hexagonal kind of pattern in the thing. Ed, when you think of TIE fighters, what do you think?
Well, I kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but, you know, based on the movies themselves, the expanded universe, the thing that I think about is speed. They are designed for speed. And I looked up some numbers as far as Wikipedia goes. X-Wing tops out at about 1,050 kilometers per hour. All right. The TIE fighter, its speed tops out at 1,200 kilometers per hour. So it is unmatched in speed from ship-to-ship combat. And the pilots are so highly trained, you know, within the Imperial Academy based on, you know, all the books and whatnot. Those are the top of the tops. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't, you know, characters like Wedge Antilles, wasn't he in the Imperial Academy before he defected to the Rebellion, Matt? Wasn't that right?
It may be. I would have to go back and look to be certain.
I think so. I know in the old expanded universe, I think Han was even in the Imperial Academy at one point. Again, I'd have to go back and look. It's in Legends. But the speed, and they kind of, with another thing it reminds me of, all of the parallels within Star Wars between that and World War II, TIE fighters always kind of reminded me as kamikaze pilots. I don't know if that ever came across to either of you, but when a pilot strapped into one of those things,
they're not expecting to come back.
There's no shielding whatsoever. If they get stranded or crippled in space, they don't have hyperdrive. All they have is impulse engines, or whatever they call it in Star Wars. Not impulse, but whatever, the full burn. But yeah. They don't have light speed. They can't. If they get stranded, they're pretty much screwed. So that's where the kamikaze parallel comes in for me.
Yeah, I think that's a good parallel. I definitely could see that. Of course, then that would mean that Palpatine is Hirohito, which I'm sure Matt would have a field day with that.
Don't get me going.
That's another show.
That'll be half a dozen episodes of just me ranting by myself.
Which we are, you know, we are planning an upcoming episode specifically on which fictional characters most embody historical world leaders. So we will get there. But let's leave that on the table for now. So that's the TIE fighter and the X-Wing. But there's, of course, a specific kind of TIE fighter. And when I asked Allison, who appeared in our first episode, what her favorite Star Wars ship was, she offered Darth Vader's specific TIE fighter. So, Ed, what are your thoughts on Vader's modified TIE?
It is the, online, it is labeled as the TIE Advanced X-1 Starfighter. It is the, with the exception of, like, the Star Destroyer and the Death Star itself within A New Hope, it was easily the most imposing ship in the first film, and rightly so. It was specially modified for Vader, to accommodate his, his suit and his, life support. And unlike the regular TIE fighters, it was equipped with deflectors and with, sublight or warp speed, light speed, hyperdrive. It was equipped with hyperdrive as well. And that's why he was able to survive after the, Death Star was destroyed. It's just a very strong, fast, ship, and it does ridiculous amounts of damage. As you could see, he was picking apart those rebel pilots like they were nothing. I mean, and we know that, he's got the force at his disposal, but I mean, the instrument itself is really good.
Yeah, it's definitely something that you do not want to see if you're piloting an X-Wing, to see that TIE fighter show up, because you probably won't see anything else. Matt, when you think of Darth Vader's TIE fighter, what do you think?
Well, Vader's TIE fighter is only ever seen with, first of all, it means he's going to have two people with him, because he's going to have those other two standard TIE fighters with him in formation, because that's how we always see it. And it really is a TIE fighter on steroids, is I think the best way to describe it.
So I have a dumb question, perhaps. It's a counterfactual, but here it goes. We all agree, all three of us, that this version of the TIE Fighter is superior in every respect to the original TIE Fighter. So why does the Empire not just scrap the old TIE Fighter line and replace them all with this version? Because they clearly haven't even done that in The Force Awakens.
In my opinion, the reason they don't is because the Advanced TIE Fighter uses a lot of additional technology that's going to add up to much, much higher per unit cost. And the average TIE fighter pilot is seen as expendable. Clearly, Darth Vader is not going to be seen as expendable.
No.
So I think that was something they did just for Vader, just so he would have access to a fighter.
Of course, now I'm picturing an accountant for the Empire like, oh, Vader, we can't afford that. Our bottom line is a little bit struggling right now.
We can create a space station the size of a moon, but we can't get our fighters advanced ties.
That's right. Don't you...
That must have been a thankless job.
I guarantee, because if the Empire is like any other government, I guarantee that Death Star went past schedule and over budget. And I don't even want to know how far over budget that thing went.
How often was there a tax increase?
They wrecked half the Empire's economy building the stupid thing. And then that's probably actually what shut down the Empire between 6 and 7. It wasn't the second Death Star being destroyed. It's they ran out of money. Like, we can't afford to do this anymore. We're all just going home.
You know, I almost said that now I want some more focus on the Star Wars economy, but then I remembered the Trade Federation, and I shuddered.
Oh, no. We don't need that plot point again.
So maybe it's best that we can just mock it without it being seen on screen.
Yeah, that works for me.
So, Matt, I know you mentioned before that, we've talked about the X-Wing, TIE Fighter, Modified TIE. There's one other Rebel small ship that I think you wanted to talk about that you find to be quite endearing. It. What ship would that be?
I really think the Y-Wing bomber is underrated, because everybody thinks about the Falcon and the X-Wing and the TIE Fighter, and the Y-Wing really tends to get short shrift, but it's a bomber. And if you'll remember from Episode 4, when they're actually doing the briefing for the Death Star run, the X-Wings weren't there to actually deliver the killing blow. They were escort fighters for the Y-Wings. The Y-Wings were actually the heavy hitters. And yeah, they're not fast ships, and they're not particularly maneuverable, but they have extremely heavy shielding, and they have a large complement of proton torpedo tubes. They are built solely around taking a beating and dropping a carpet bombing on someone.
So in RPG terms, they're a tank.
They're the tank. They're
not
the tank.
Literally.
And when they get into striking range, they may not come at you fast, but when they hit you, you're not getting back up.
So George Foreman.
I'm thinking, yeah, yeah.
Not fast, but it packs a punch.
They're too slow to be Ali.
No, yeah, no. Ali's more like the X-Wing. Scrappy and will do a lot of damage. Well, probably more like Darth Vader's TIE Fighter. Everyone's going to go down for a count.
More like Darth Vader's TIE Fighter with a super laser.
Pretty much. So, Ed, do you think the Y-Wing is underrated?
I think there are several ships that are underrated just simply because they are not as shown as prominently within the films, the Y-Wing being one of them, the A-Wing. Then you could go to the Imperial side and talk about the TIE Interceptors and TIE Bombers. There's just a vast array of ships in there, and it was kind of confusing to me that, you know, within Episode 7, yeah, X-Wing's my favorite, but the Rebels used more than that. But however, when they were having the space battle against, you know, and the runs on Starkiller Base, it was all X-Wings. I didn't quite understand why they didn't include any of the other ships. But yeah, the Y-Wing was a great... and if you play any of the video games, like the old... what were they? What were the Star Wars games like on the GameCube? They were the fighter pilot games.
Rogue Squadron?
Rogue Squadron, yeah. Rogue Squadron. I mean, the Y-Fighter, I use that quite a bit. The A-Wing and the X-Wing. I think they're all underrated.
They're a little bit easier to use, in all honesty, on the game. And
yeah.
They pack a bigger punch, and you can take more damage. So, I do want to talk about one more small-scale ship before we go to the big boys. One of my favorites is actually the Lambda-class shuttle of the Emperor. First seen in Return of the Jedi, and then, of course, it was added into the Empire in the special edition because Lucas. I really have always enjoyed the Lambda-class design. I think... I didn't know before you saw it, you could have a combination of imposing yet graceful. And I think that's a good way to describe the Lambda-class shuttle. And if you're not aware of what I'm talking about, listeners, it's the shuttle that the Emperor uses when he first lands in the Death Star. It has the three flaps, and then the two bottom flaps fold up to make a perfect triangle when it lands. Even though it's small, it is incredibly imposing. It really does connote the Empire and its ability to have sleek designs that are, to use a historical term, it reminds me of the Bauhaus school of design out of Weimar, Germany, which is probably no accident, considering the parallels between the Empire and the Nazis. But it's very stark, very sleek, it's mathematically precise, the folding is done precisely when it lands. It really does make me believe that this is the ship of the Emperor. Obviously, the Emperor wants a larger craft. He has the Death Star for that and other things. But that is his go-to ship for ship-to-ship. It's sort of the equivalent of Air Force One for a much more evil force. So I always appreciated the design of that ship. And I was very happy they had a modified version of it in The Force Awakens for Kylo. So I always thought the Lambda-class ship was a good design, especially for the character that it's trying to convey, quite literally. What do you guys think about the Lambda-class ship?
Well, for the Lambda-class, the thing that I actually think is the scariest about the ship is that it's honestly kind of arrogant. The ship itself actually feels arrogant because it's unarmed. As far as I'm aware, it's unshielded, and it's a literal example of, I am so secure in my power that I feel no need to defend myself against external threats. And that's just borderline arrogant to me. Which is, I think, a major part of the Emperor's character. And like we were talking about earlier, these ships tend to embody the personality of the person most associated with them.
And just like Luke is embodied in the X-Wing, the Emperor is certainly embodied in the Lambda-class ship.
It's very much a, I'm not worried about you coming at me. I do what I want, and you can't stop me.
And if you try, you will fail.
Right.
I mean, you're right. It's not an imposing ship in terms of what it can do to you. It's imposing because it represents sheer arrogance.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
It's the spaceship version of the phrase, I do what I want.
It's the Eric Cartman of spaceships.
Yes, I get him.
And now I'm picturing Cartman in the Star Wars universe, and that's just a whole other show. So, Ed, do you have any strong opinions on the Lambda-class vessel?
It's kind of been touched on between you guys, but aesthetically, even though it's, you know, arrogant, I like the design, and as you said, Josh, the way it lands as the wings are folding up, I mean, that's just cool. I mean, that is just freaking cool. Is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just the scenes in Empire and Return of the Jedi, where the dock comes down and the Emperor just comes strolling out. I mean, that's an iconic scene in the franchise, and you know it's coming right off the out of the cargo or right out of the quarters of that ship, and I think it's a great ship.
Mm-hmm. So
if I'm not mistaken, wasn't the didn't the Rebels steal a Lambda class ship to take to
that's how they got to Endor in Jedi.
So it had more than one use. So
now we move on to the next size up kind of category. And there's two major ones I want to talk about in this next category. The first, I talked to a gentleman named Doug, and his favorite ship is the Slave One, Boba Fett's ship. And it, actually, when you look up best ships online, this ship is beloved by some and hated by others. So I'm curious as to where you guys fall. Ed, I'll start with you. Where do you start? Where do you fall on Slave One?
All right. As we've mentioned two or three times now, I feel that the ship is representative of the character. I think it's very appropriately matched to Jango Fett in the prequels and Boba Fett in the original series. However, I also feel that Boba Fett's a very overrated character. He had only a handful of lines within the film, and then he got blinded and... Or no, he got knocked into the Sarlacc by a blinded Han Solo. So, you know, without the expanded universe, just based on the films alone, I think it's an overrated character. The ship, though, is a badass-looking ship. It is cool that I don't even know how to describe that design. It's just imposing, and the paint scheme on the hull of that thing is really cool-looking.
Yeah, when I first saw Slave One, I thought cool as well. But I tend to agree with you that Boba Fett is overrated to an extent. Certainly he's overrated by the people who think he's the best character in the franchise.
When
it's not even a fair thing to say because he's so... I'm sorry, Boba Fett fans, but he's such an insignificant character in the grand scheme of the franchise. You can't make him the biggest name of all. You just can't, especially considering he was disposed of by a blinded Han Solo. Yes, he's cool, and yes, he's the silent killer. He has the same aura, in a way, as Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. It's kind of an odd parallel, but it's there. The same kind of, you know, anti-hero kind of thing. A villain that's just so imposing and so mysterious, but in the same token, you cannot in any way, shape, or form claim that Boba Fett is more significant to the franchise than Luke, or Han, or Vader, or Palpatine, or the droids, or Leia. You just can't do it. It's not a defendable position in terms of how the franchise is structured. That said, Slave One is a great ship for that character, although... If I were a bounty hunter, I would make sure my ship was as stealthy as possible And that ship just screams Boba Fett. It's not stealthy at all. Matt, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that when you started saying Anton, my brain did jump straight to Antoine Dodson.
So all I can think of is,
had your kids, had your wife. But for me, when I first saw Star Wars, when I was considerably younger than I am now, when I saw the Slave One, I was blown away by it. But the Slave One is much like certain words in the English language, where the more you look at it, the sillier and more wrong it looks. It's one of those things that, as long as you avoid close examination, it's this scary, imposing, badass, I'm going to destroy you ship. But then you start to think about it, and the more you think about it, the sillier it gets. Because it flies in a vertical position. And in the vertical position, it actually looks like the Mandalorian shape of the visor in his helmet. It looks a lot like a stylized version of his helmet. Which, yeah, makes it scream Boba Fett even more.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when it lands basically flat on its back.
It's a very submissive ship.
50 Shades of Boba.
I will take spin-offs I never want to see in life for 1,000, Alex. But it's just, what position is the pilot seat going to be in? Is he going to be looking straight up? How is he going to get in and out of the seat in that armor, especially if he doesn't take off his jetpack? Because it's Boba Fett, so you know that jetpack's not coming off.
Let's be fair for a minute. I mean, within the confines of the film, what did the Slave One do? I'm having trouble, besides tracking the Falcon and showing up at Cloud City and leaving with Han, those are the only things I remember.
Well, that's the thing. Those are the only things it did. The reason people are so invested in Boba Fett, and I admit, before I started really thinking about Star Wars and reading into the expanded universe and everything, before that, I was kind of a Boba groupie, but it's just all he did, and the reason people are like, oh, Boba Fett's so great, is he's the one who got Han. That's all there is to it. They're like, he got Han Solo. You know, leaving out the part that it never would have happened without Darth freaking Vader and Lando Calrissian being involved. It's like, right. Han Solo was handed to him. He didn't catch him. He tracked him. He did successfully track him to Bespin, to Cloud City. But if it had not been for the direct intervention of the Empire itself, at quite literally the highest levels, with the personal involvement of Darth Vader, threatening Lando Calrissian into turning Han in, Boba Fett never, ever would have had a chance of leaving anywhere with Han Solo, let alone encased in carbonite.
You know, again, the ship is completely representative of the character because it did so few things. I would even argue that pretty much every ship within the franchise is more important than Slave One within the confines of the film because they've done so much more. The X-Wings, the Y-Wings, the TIE Fighters, the TAN-T4, for crying out loud. All of them have done more than the Slave One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say that's a good way to wrap up Slave One and move on to the other ship that's synonymous with its pilot. I am talking, of course, about our favorite bucket of bolts, the Millennium Falcon. And I will tell you, I have been asking this question to people for the past couple weeks in getting ready for this episode. Everyone said the Millennium Falcon is beloved, but nobody I've talked to picked it as the best ship. So I'm wondering if you guys share the same kind of love, but recognition that it's not the best ship. What do you guys think?
Matt, you want to go first?
Yeah, I think I will. The Millennium Falcon is, I think, extremely unique. And that's actually a big part of the reason that we got our sponsor for this episode. Because the Millennium Falcon is one of three ships in the entire franchise. Three in the entire franchise that are unique. Because TIE fighters are mass-produced, X-Wings mass-produced, Y-Wings mass-produced, and I don't really count the Death Star as a ship, because technically it's a mobile space station.
Fair enough.
But, you know, there's three unique ships, and that's counting Darth Vader's TIE fighter as one of them. Everything else is mass-produced. And yes, the Millennium Falcon is technically a mass-produced ship, because it's a Corellian Engineering YT-1300 light frigate, but it is so heavily modified that it only looks like one. Every part of that ship is aftermarket, except for, you know, the paint, pretty much. The paint and the windows are original, I think, and that's about it. It's so extremely heavily modified that it becomes unique, and there's the 14 parsecs claim that gets much maligned by fans, pointing out a weak grasp of space and units of measure on George Lucas's part, but I actually argue that it's brilliant, saying he could do the Kessel run in 14 parsecs, because within the expanded universe, it's considered common knowledge that their galaxy is infested with black holes. So being able to say, I could do it in 14 parsecs, yes, that is a measure of distance, but the Kessel run is a set route. And by saying he can do it in only that distance is saying I can get much closer to the black holes and fly much more precisely than anyone else. And that's opposed to the capabilities of the ship and the capability of the pilot. He's saying he can get closer to the event horizon than anybody else. Yeah, and that's balls.
It is, but it brings up a point, you know, with all of these ships, it's associated with its pilot. Han Solo is one of the most beloved characters in the entire franchise. Do we as fans give the Falcon so much love simply because it's Han's ship? In other words, if the Falcon belonged to somebody else, say Mon Mothma, would it still be such a beloved scrappy bucket of bolts?
I would say no. And my reasoning for this has nothing to do with the ship. It's that I don't think Mon Mothma would know what to do with that ship. I think Mon Mothma would treat that thing like a Lambda shuttle and just use it to bounce around within the Rebel fleet. But just about every floorboard in that ship is a hidden compartment. It's got heavily modified engines that allow extremely high hyperspace speeds. It can go well past light speed. It has maneuvering capabilities that, while it is not physically as maneuverable as an X-Wing, it can run circles around a lot of ships that are getting in dogfights, like the Y-Wing. It can run circles around it, and not only does it have the two forward laser cannons, it has a top and bottom mounted quad cannon laser turret.
Don't get cocky.
Yeah. The only way that ship cannot hit you when you are approaching it is if you are perfectly level with the engines coming at it at a perfectly straight angle. You straight up or down maybe 10 feet and you're catching quad cannon no matter what direction you're coming from.
Supposing the Falcon has a complete crew to run everything.
Yes.
That's the only thing. Because those turrets that they used, they had to be manually handled. So if it's just Han and Chewie piloting the thing, and Chewie takes the helm and Han goes down, you know, you're only going to have so much firepower to throw at it, but with a fully complemented staff, it's pretty unstoppable.
Yeah, when they had Luke and Han in there, they were ripping TIE fighters apart. Left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke didn't know what he was doing. Luke had never used a quad cannon before in his life.
It's just like shooting rats.
Well, I want rats no bigger than my T-16 back home.
This kid slaughters animals. I don't know if we want to let him into the rebellion.
Well, I mean, his father does have a predisposition for certain violent tendencies.
Yeah.
Sounds like an episode waiting to happen.
It is, and we're actually going to get into Nature and Nurture in a later episode, but we're actually going to use a different character for Nature and Nurture, a certain beloved Marvel villain, but that's a later show. I'll leave that out there.
Yeah, I know where you're going with that.
Oh, yeah. So the Millennium Falcon is, I think we'll talk about the favorite ship here in a minute at the end, but is it safe to say the Millennium Falcon is the most iconic ship?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, when you think of Star Wars, yes, you think X-Wing or Vader, but I think most people would, if you show them the Millennium Falcon, even if they haven't seen Star Wars, they can tell you it's Star Wars.
When I went to see Episode 7 in the theater, and they first show the Falcon.
Everyone cheered.
When it first takes off and that tarp comes down, you couldn't hear the next 3 minutes of the movie. hear anything in that theater for 3 solid minutes. And I went to a matinee.
I went opening night, first show, sold out, and it was exactly the same. It was fantastic. When they're running past it, and they're like, no, not that one, that one's garbage. And then the other thing gets blown up. She's like, the garbage will do. And then you turn around and see what it is. The entire crowd lost it. I mean, completely.
Yeah, that was amazing.
They didn't get that kind of reception for any X-Wings. And X-Wing's my and X-Wing is my personal favorite. So, I mean, it's up there. It's with the Enterprise. It's with Serenity. It's, you know, it's that good.
X-Wing is iconic. It is iconic. But the Millennium Falcon elicits an emotional reaction. I think it has the most emotional attachment for the fans.
I
think that's how the Enterprise is for Trekkies. It's you see it and it brings up certain feelings.
There are stories. When the first Star Trek film came out in 1979, Star Trek The Motion Picture, if you guys will recall, there's a scene in there where we see the Enterprise on screen for the first time in over a decade. And they actually spend about 4 minutes taking Kirk in a shuttle around the Enterprise with the theme of the franchise playing in Jerry Goldsmith's incredibly beautiful score. And there are stories that I've read where I wish I could have been there in that theater where Trekkies were actually tearing up because their franchise had arrived.
Yeah.
And to see the Enterprise on screen, refitted to look good for a screen, but still distinctly the Enterprise.
Yeah.
It was a hell of a moment.
You're gunning at criers.
It was a hell of a moment. And it's the same kind of thing with the Falcon showed up. And well done to Abrams for presenting it in that way too. Of course it would be the trash pile.
It was appropriate. It was so appropriate.
Yeah, it was a very Millennium Falcon moment, let's be honest.
And if you go back and look at it, retrospectively, not having Han in the Falcon to begin with in that film is kind of an early indicator that when Rey is the one that pilots it, she's going to be the one that pilots it. You could look back on it and see, well, it was intended to go to her through the course of that story, and you could kind of pick up on it because Han didn't have it at the beginning of the film.
Well, I've actually said from seeing it that Rey is sort of a combination character of Han and Luke.
I could see that.
Because she has the Force like Luke, but she's also the natural pilot and is the mechanic like Han, and she has some of Han's swagger. So I kind of see her as kind of in the middle. Maybe that's a little bit of a hint to her origin, which we'll hopefully find out more in Episode 8. But I think she's definitely got some Solo characteristics, even though she's more of the Luke archetype. She's definitely got more of a Han in her, too.
Yeah, I think a great Han moment that she has in Episode 7 is when Han goes to hand her a blaster, she says, I can take care of myself. And he says, I know, that's why I'm giving it to you.
That was fantastic. And then the back and forth about them fixing the Falcon as they were on it. That was so perfect. Those were some of the best scenes of an already good movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to move on to the last category. I think we're going to talk about before we get into some other random ships. The biggest boys, the base ships. And before we get into the Star Destroyers, because those deserve some attention, I actually did speak to one person who shall remain nameless, who said their favorite ship was the Mon Calamari ship of Admiral Akbar in Return of the Jedi. And Ed, you're already laughing. Why are you laughing at their perfectly valid choice?
It is a perfectly valid choice. It's just a humorous choice to me.
Yes, it is.
When you think about the franchise, that's not the first one that pops into your head. It's not even the tenth one that pops into your head. But I mean, and that's a fair point, because one of my ships that I really enjoyed was the Outrider from Star Wars: Shadows of the Empire, the novel. That's Dash Rendar's ship, and it's another Corellian fighter. So it's a perfectly valid choice. So it's just because these ships are tailored to the Mon Calamari physiology, it's not necessarily comfortable for humanoids.
No, they may have left a bit too much ink on the blueprint, if you know what I mean.
It was a trap.
but I asked someone else about this ship, and they actually said when they picture it, they picture, quote, a bulbous mess. Is that a fair description?
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a bad base ship. I mean, clearly they won the battle in Jedi, but it doesn't really connote sleek or beautiful or anything like that.
It doesn't. I mean, I pulled up a picture as we were discussing it just to, refresh my memory. It's not an attractive looking ship at all.
No.
Not the slightest.
But hey, if you're into Admiral Akbar, if that's your thing, that's fine.
In fairness, though, it has wonderful trap detection capabilities.
Yes, absolutely. And I will say that whoever made that choice, it's not a fishy decision. I understand it.
I'm not dignifying that with a laugh.
No, I realize that you're not, so I'm going to move on to the equivalent on the Empire side, the Star Destroyer and the Super Star Destroyer.
Oh, man.
So we're talking about the big ones here that potentially could be mistaken for slices of moon cheese, but are in fact the hosses of the universe. Matt, when you picture the Star Destroyer and the Super Star Destroyer, what are its pros and cons?
For me, the Star Destroyer, the biggest con for a Star Destroyer for me is the fact that it can't go planet side, because once that thing goes planet side, it ain't coming back up.
No,
it is not making it back out of the atmosphere. So, but I don't think that's the purpose of it either. I think the purpose of the Star Destroyer is frankly to put the fear of God into you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because you see that damn thing coming for you, and I'll tell you right now, 99% of the time, people are just going to be like, we're not doing this.
Just from a filmmaking perspective, it was brilliant in A New Hope to start with the Tantive IV fleeing from a Star Destroyer. It shows you immediately what the heroes are up against in sheer size and scale,
yes,
just from a filmography standpoint, and it was fantastic.
Because the Tantive IV looks big at first.
Yeah,
And
then it's a Victory class. And the Victory class isn't even the largest classes of Star Destroyers, not even counting the Supers. And that's a Victory class that comes overhead. And this ship that they spent a full minute crawling across, wow, it's huge. And then it is just dwarfed. And it's yanked up into a docking bay like it's a toy.
Yep.
And it's like, that'll scare the hell out of you. I don't care who you are or how big your ship is. If suddenly a Star Destroyer comes up on you, if you're not as crazy as Han Solo, you're giving up.
Yeah.
Those things are just flying masses of pure imperialism. They are the absolute embodiment of it. I don't mean just of the Empire. I mean of the concept of imperialism.
The only way to make them more imperial is to make them wear a pith helmet and sip tea at 4 o'clock.
Yeah. I mean, you can just feel the desire to oppress other people just pouring out. In fact, I believe it may, in fact, be powered by the tears of Twi'leks.
And I also say that the Empire might be at its most scary in Empire Strikes Back when they have no Death Stars and are running out of Star Destroyers. Because the Empire can more easily get to you, as in Hoth. And it's a frightening thing.
Do you remember the shot they have in space during Empire Strikes Back? I believe it's near the beginning of the film. And they just show all the Star Destroyers together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is terrifying. Because before that, in A New Hope, you see one Star Destroyer. You see one. And then in Empire, you see dozens and dozens. And then it pans up to the freaking Executor.
Which dwarfs the rest.
Yeah, that's the Super Star Destroyer that looks like an 8-kilometer arrowhead.
Yeah.
And it's solid black.
Ew. Why did the Empire invest in a second Death Star and kill their economy when they could have just stuck with the Executor and all those small Star Destroyers? And they would have been just fine.
For the same reason that the New Order invested in a quote-unquote third Death Star in the Starkiller base, because it worked so well the first two times.
Well, there is a fan theory. We all know I enjoy my fan theories. There's actually a fan theory that the entire purpose of the Death Star, and of course, this would actually hold up in Legends. It wouldn't hold up in current canon. But using the Legends canon, it would actually make sense to build it if the Emperor knew about the Yuuzhan Vong.
Yes, yes, it would. And that's another ship entirely. I don't know if we're going to get to it, but their ships are frightening.
Well, I mean, I think now we can actually, you know, we're coming toward the end here. So I want to open up the floor for, I've talked about all the most common ships people know of and people have mentioned to me. So what are some ships that are below the radar that you think merit mention? Ed, we might as well start there, Ed, with the Yuuzhan Vong vessels.
Well, okay, and I will preface this by saying I have not read all of that part of the Legends canon. I'm just aware of the ships. They were called Coral Skippers. It's a living spaceship. It's biomatter. It is, let me, I've got a few notes here. It's only 400 kilometers an hour, but where this thing is interesting, the weaponry, the armament of this is different than anything the Empire or the Rebels ever had. It has these cannons that fire, it's basically searing magma rock out of the front of this thing at oncoming craft and just obliterates them. And the ship itself is fueled and rearmed by eating rocks and asteroids and refuse in space, whatever. It's got these things called Dovin Basals, which are small creatures that resemble heart. It functions basically as a miniature black hole with inside the ship. And it can use to overload enemy shielding and enhance theirs. And it's got a wicked fast 180 degree turn radius while at full sublight engines. It can turn on a dime going as fast as it can and compensate so it doesn't kill the pilot.
Wow. So it's pretty damn imposing.
And within the Legends, the Rebels were so hard pressed, they were getting their ass kicked by these guys for the first part of that war. They couldn't stand up to it. They couldn't do a thing.
In a strange way, it reminds me of the same kind of effect of the Borg.
Yeah.
And you said you didn't read too much of those novels?
No, not that portion of the series, no.
If I recall correctly, and it has been many years since I've read it, those ships were actually, at least some of them were built by terraforming a planet and turning it into one of those ships.
That would add up with it. And that's a very interesting ship, and the fact that these ace pilots who had stood up to the Empire and beat them were not able to do a damn thing about it, that speaks volumes.
Well, it also doesn't help that the way Jedi have to see the Yuuzhan Vong through the Force is not to see them through the Force, but look for places where the Force does not exist.
Yeah.
Because the Yuuzhan Vong aren't just not sensitive to the Force, they are not subject to the Force. They are not part of it.
Major plot twist, it turns out that the Gungans are the proto-form of an unevolved Yuuzhan Vong.
Way to make him even more evil.
And there you go. The Gungans are time warped back millennia and evolved into the Yuuzhan Vong, so that Jar Jar Binks is in fact the biggest enemy of everyone in the Star Wars universe.
They're just trying to come in to make sure Jar Jar's dead. Whole Yuuzhan Vong invasion, take over a galaxy. We just really want to make sure Jar Jar's gone, okay, guys?
We were hired by this podcast on Earth called BNQ. We're just doing a job.
You know, going back to your guys' discussion in an earlier episode about what you would do with time travel, why did none of you mention going back and stopping George Lucas from creating that thing?
Because then we wouldn't have our closing bit.
Well, we could come up with something else. Yeah, this is true.
I mean, that's why I didn't do it.
Sometimes honesty is the best policy. Matt, is there another obscure ship that you want to bring into the discussion?
Well, we've really brought up the ones that I'm most interested in, but one ship I would really absolutely just love to smack talk is Amidala's ship.
Ooh. Oh yeah, that thing.
The Nubian Royal starship. The J-Type 327. Can I just say that is the ugliest damn thing in the entire franchise? Like, in the entire intellectual property, it is the ugliest thing.
Yeah.
It is not an attractive craft.
It's solid chrome.
You wanted to talk about...
Did Ludacris design it? Seriously?
We were talking about the design from the Lambda class being arrogant. I mean, I think this one puts it to shame.
The thing is, I think it goes so far beyond that that it's not even arrogant anymore. It just went full on asinine. It's like somebody, it's like somebody took their ship to Pimp My Ride, and Ludacris is like, yo, dog, I heard you like bling, so we chromed your entire ship.
There's so probably you three TVs inside.
It's like bling.
That is an ugly ship.
This is exactly what would happen if Ludacris became a billionaire, okay? That's what would happen.
I think the host of Pit My Ride was Exhibit.
It's Exhibit, yeah.
But
Ludacris would do it too.
He would, and honestly, the whole ship design is in fact Ludacris, so I can see why the confusion was there.
Yeah.
It's all chrome. It's like... Okay, did a 1950s hot rodder design your ship? And did he do so while high? Because that's the only explanation that makes sense. Oh, wait, there's one other one. George Lucas.
It's just...
I mean, George Lucas, as you've said on this show before, it's like he is the yin and yang of good content. Because for every Star Wars A New Hope, for every Raiders of the Lost Ark, you have... a chrome ship, Jar Jar Binks, and a crystal skull.
And you know, to actually bring X-Men the Animated Series into it, because I can, I'll tell you exactly what it looks like. What it looks like. If you look up her ship, and you put it side by side with a picture of an SR-71 Blackbird, it looks like somebody clipped the wings on an SR-71 Blackbird and then dipped the whole damn thing in chrome.
You're right.
But the Blackbird is fine the way it is.
Yeah, and the Blackbird isn't asinine. And instead of carrying Gungans, it carries a Canadian with adamantium claws.
You know,
now I want to see that Canadian fight a Gungan.
Yes.
I've said this before, and I might have even said it on the show. You know, George Lucas has made some very questionable and very poor decisions as a screenwriter and director and all that stuff. But I stand by my point of view. It is his mess to make because it's his world. Whereas, say, for instance, that Hobbit trilogy by Peter Jackson, I thought was awful. Awful. He's messing somebody else's world up. That's not excusable.
Yeah.
I see the point there, absolutely. And I think that will be another B&Q down the road on what is the biggest injustice against a beloved franchise, because that question is ripe for discussion and mockery. But for this episode, unless there's one more you'd like to talk about, Ed, I think it's time for us to pick our favorites. Are we okay with going there?
I'm all right going there.
All right, so, drum roll, please. It is time to pick the best ship in the Star Wars universe, and best can be defined however you want it to be. Ed, I'm going to start with you. You said at the beginning of the show that the X-Wing is your favorite, but is it also your pick for best?
I'm going to stick with it. The T-65B X-Wing, not just because it's my favorite, but because of the impact it has had on the series as a whole. Every major dogfight, every major victory, that ship's been a part of, and there's a good reason for it.
One vote for X-Wing. Matt, where does your vote lie?
Okay. I'm actually going to give a few different rulings.
All right.
I'm going to give a few different opinions, and then I'm going to end with what I think is the best ship. I think the most underrated ship, but not the best ship in Star Wars, the most underrated is the Y-Wing. Because I think it gets just seen as part of the background, and it's exceptionally functional, it's got great power, but I think it just gets ignored unjustly. But I don't think it's the best ship. I think the worst ship is honestly the Slave One.
Wow.
I'm gonna get some hate mail for that, and I know I will. But it's maneuverable, it's stealthy, it's good for tracking. But it doesn't really do anything.
And the fan base for Boba Fett's kind of obnoxious as well.
Yeah, I'll have to admit that. But as far as the best ship, for me to judge the best ship, I have to say, okay, form after function. And the most versatile ship and the highest impact ship that has the greatest versatility to me, and I'm sorry for jumping on a bandwagon here, but I gotta give it to the Falcon. I think that one of the biggest problems of the prequels was that it was pre-Millennium Falcon. I think that ship is one of the most central characters in the franchise. And I honestly don't think we would have had the same epic space opera if he had been flying just a regular freighter, or if he had used different ships to sneak around.
That is an inspired pick.
I think it is too important of a ship to the franchise. Because the X-Wing, and don't get me wrong, X-Wing's my number two. And it's a close number two. But the X-Wing could be replaced. They're mass-produced. It's not a specific X-Wing. With the Millennium Falcon, yes, it's a YT-1300. But it's the only one like it. You know the Falcon when you see it coming.
Yeah.
It elicits a primal emotional reaction from the fans that you don't get anywhere else.
I appreciate your pick with the Falcon, and I appreciate your pick, Ed, with the X-Wing. My pick is probably a little bit unexpected, but my pick for the best ship in the franchise is actually the Victory-class Star Destroyer. And the reason is exactly what we said earlier in the beginning of A New Hope. You immediately, because of that ship, recognize how strong the Empire is, how much the Rebellion's going to have to do to win their struggle 3 movies down the road, as it turns out. I also am of the opinion, which I said earlier, that if the Empire had not wasted all their resources on Death Star 1, Death Star 2, Electric Boogaloo, and Death Star 3, we're going to have to do something entirely different, but no, it's the same thing. If they would focus on their Star Destroyers, Excelsior and Victory Class and the others, they'd be a better empire, so to speak. They already have a central base of the planet on Coruscant. You don't need a Death Star unless you subscribe to the Yusong Vong theory. Excluding that, you could have easily stamped down the rebellion. With the resources you put into building the Death Star, they could have built probably 100 additional Victory-class Star Destroyers, and they could have stamped down their rebellion in every corner of the galaxy simultaneously. That ship is imperialism personified, and as a historian of imperialism, I appreciate taking such a concept that is so amorphous and turning it into something that is tangible. That ship connotes fear, it connotes power, it connotes arrogance, and when it's destroyed, it is supremely satisfying. One of the most satisfying moments of the entire franchise is the destruction of the Star Destroyer when this vessel goes straight through its view screen. And for those reasons, I pick the Victory Class Star Destroyer. All their ships are amazing, but that's why I think without the Star Destroyers, the franchise itself falls apart in its construction of the villain.
That's a fair choice.
But that's my pick. So we've got three great picks here. We've got the Star Destroyer, we've got the X-Wing, and we've got the Millennium Falcon. But what is your pick, loyal listeners? Please let us know about your Star Wars ship affectionate relationship with the ships. Let us know through email, bnqfeedback@gmail.com or bignerdyquestion@gmail.com. You can also send us a tweet at bnqpodcast. We are nearing 2,000 followers, and we would like you to be one of them. So please follow us on Twitter if you're not doing so already. So I believe that wraps up our Star Wars ships discussion. We'll have to light speed away to our next episode. So thank you, Ed.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you, Matt. But I believe, Matt, you have one more thing to take care of, don't you, sir?
Yes, that's right. You see, we couldn't possibly ever become negligent and allow Jar Jar to survive an episode.
No.
So today, in fact, during our episode today, while we were discussing TIE fighters, one was stolen by a young pilot named Poe Dameron, who then crash landed it on Jar Jar Binks.
Nice. Poe is the hero we deserve.
Yes.
I knew I liked that cocky guy for a reason. Yes.
Thank you, Poe. Hashtag thank you, Poe.
Can we get Oscar Isaacs on the show, please?
I would love to. But I think, you know, thank you, Matt, for killing off Jar Jar in such a satisfying way. I just love the idea of Gungan crushing. But thank you, Ed, and thank you, Matt, for a wonderful episode. And for Ed and Matt, this is Josh signing off for Big Nerdy Questions. We will see you next time.